The world is wealthier than it's ever been. We make more, sell more, and consume more than ever before. Yet 3 billion people, nearly half the global population, still live on less than $2.50 a day, and inequality is rife. So, where do we go from here? I'm Theo Leggett, and as part of the BBC's Richer World season, I'm asking, can the world get richer forever? Over the next hour, I'll be talking to leading thinkers from the fields of economics, business, science, and environmentalism to find out what they believe. We'll be hearing why the laws of physics mean economic growth as we know it simply can't go on forever.
From a physical point of view, if we grew at 3% in something like 400 years, we would actually be boiling the oceans, not because of global warming and CO2, but just because of the heat that is a natural byproduct of the energy that we use.
Or perhaps it can, after all.
I don't see significant barriers to sustaining economic growth for an extraordinary length of time. And I think the biggest risks to that are less around resource conservation, but the broader environmental issues and political issues the world faces at the moment, which are some of them are very serious.
And do we measure global riches in the right way? Or do we need to rethink what we mean by increasing wealth?
Being rich means living a full life, living a life of meaning, having work for your hands and your minds and your heart, having a wide circle of compassion to give. On that, there is no limit.
What you can hear is the sound of revolution, the Industrial Revolution. I'm talking to you from the Power Hall of the Museum of Science and Industry in the English town of Manchester. Behind me is the vast bulk of a Galloway steam engine. It once powered one of the many textile mills which covered this region. From the mid-18th century onwards, the development of large-scale machines like this one utterly changed the way goods were produced and distributed around the world. In Europe and North America, societies which had previously been based largely on farming became increasingly dependent on trade and industry. Humble market towns like Manchester became thriving cities. Factories took the place of fields, and chimneys spewed out smoke. But this revolution didn't just bring about a soot-laden transformation of the landscape. It also led to wealth generation on a scale never seen before, a new age of economic growth.
Nowadays, of course, we tend to take economic growth for granted, and it's almost always seen as a good thing. Journalists like me frequently describe rapid growth as robust or healthy. Weak growth is anemic, while a country in recession is often portrayed as sick or ailing, and politicians use similar language.
The country has officially entered recession. New figures show the biggest fall in economic output in a generation, sparking fears of a deep and prolonged slump. Gordon Brown said, "Mother, too tired to
mention." Investors here on Wall Street will be paying close attention to the latest growth figures, looking for signs the slowdown in the global economy is having an effect here in the U.S. or in the world.
G20 leaders said the global recovery was slow, uneven, and not delivering the jobs needed. So today they set themselves a new target, to grow their economies by at least 2% above expected trends.
We know that the costs of continued sluggish growth are high, modest income gains, meager reductions of unemployment and inequality.
There's a good reason why economic growth is seen in these terms. In theory, at least, it creates jobs, boosts tax revenues, and helps governments to pay their way. In poorer countries, it can lift people out of poverty. But before we go any further, what do we actually mean by economic growth? Here's a brief outline from Gillian Tett, well-known columnist with the Financial Times.
Economic growth, as defined by economists, is all about the size of output, the size of consumption, and a lot of other numbers that you can put into a spreadsheet. It's worth remembering, though, that that's actually quite a modern concept. If you go back a few centuries or even millennia, you get a much more broadly based vision of prosperity and human well-being. Anthropologists and sociologists often like to argue that the vision of the economy put forward by orthodox economists is much too narrow. People don't think about their lives in terms of numbers in a bank or in terms of spreadsheets and things like that. They look at their total sense of well-being and prosperity, and maybe that's the kind of thing we should all be focusing on much more these days.
Gillian Tett there, and I'll be asking whether we need to rethink what we actually mean by wealth and prosperity later in the programme. But first, I want to focus on the definition used by economists and, generally speaking, governments as well. This sees economic growth as a measure of increasing output of goods and services, of gross domestic product. With this kind of growth comes mounting demand for natural resources and for energy to fuel our industries, grow our food, and to provide light and warmth for our homes. But we live on a finite planet, and our resources are limited. So can this kind of growth continue indefinitely? Can we really get richer forever? Well, first of all, let's take a view from the financial industry. Joe Seifert is a former high-flying investment banker. He now works as Chief Investment Officer for SR Capital, an India-based fund which manages assets around the world worth more than $12 billion. He's a busy man and he spends much of his life on aeroplanes. And so I caught up with him, as you might expect, at an airport.
I think the history of, since the Industrial Revolution, the last few hundred years, the world has been surprisingly resilient through world wars and famines and catastrophes, and its ability to sustain growth, and particularly in North America and Western Europe, there's been sustained growth for a very long time. And the world has learned a lot how to manage a lot better environmental issues, economic issues, social issues, political issues. So I'm very optimistic around the future ability of the world to generate wealth. And obviously the last 20 years we've seen the growth of new economies, particularly China and now to a degree, a large degree, India and other countries. I think the ultimate question is, to what extent are certain resources finite and how can we manage that as a globe? But again, the commodities boom the last 10 years, products that were thought to be scarce, whether it's crude oil, to a degree, copper and others, the world's shown an amazing ability to, if capital is allocated correctly to those sectors, and expertise that there is today through technology and focus and money, has been able to substantially increase capacity. And now we're standing in an environment where the price of these commodities has dropped considerably. So the long run question is always a difficult one, but I think, to me, I don't see significant barriers to sustaining economic growth for an extraordinary length of time. And I think the biggest risks to that are less around resource conservation, but the broader environmental issues and political issues the world faces at the moment, which are some of them are very serious.
Well, that's exactly the point, isn't it? Even if we can keep on finding resources, the consequences of using those resources could be severe. What answers do you see? What solutions do you see to that problem?
Well, it becomes a very difficult, I think, question. I mean, the good news is the creation of new technologies and certain new resources means, for example, the gas boom in America has meant that their actual pollution levels are significantly lower than you would have predicted. Obviously, the efficiency of cars and manufacturing is much greater, and regulation has got to keep, and governments have got to keep out to play in that. I think where it becomes difficult is the growing emerging world obviously is a very heavy user of more basic materials, and obviously coal is a significant one, which is absolutely required. I mean, in India, 400 million people have no access to electricity. Of course, they must have a right to that electricity. I think the hope is just like the UK and the US, which is, yes, economies will need to use basic resources that are pollution, more pollution intensive than we'd all like, but are necessary for those countries to give their citizens at least a basic form of life. But over time, as they become richer, they can substitute with less resource-intense technologies. They can build more service economies, as we've seen quite successfully in Western Europe and in North America. And there's all the great photos of British industrial cities covered in smog. And you go there today and they're very clean and well-maintained. So there's a very difficult political element as well, I think, to the environmental impact the growth of certain economies is having on the globe today.
And do you think that growth also equates to prosperity? That if countries are growing, if countries are getting richer, communities, populations are getting richer as well?
Well, I think the good news is, like in most economic subjects, right now there's actually a lot of factual evidence about what actually has happened. And unfortunately, the correlation between economic growth and prosperity for a population is actually pretty poor. There are many countries, including ones in Western Europe and North America, where growth has been very good, but real incomes for ordinary people have not increased to the same degree. Also, if we take more, what I'd say, broader and more appropriate measures of actual happiness and prosperity, including environmental conditions, quality of life, while some areas have got better, others have sustained or even got slightly worse. So I do think it's a fundamental point, which is, you know, the world has got richer, but the split of that increased wealth has really been heavily skewed, particularly in the last 15, 20 years, to the top few. And that's a fundamental question, I think, is less about do we have enough resources to sustain growth forever, but do we have enough resources to share properly so that people who are less well off can also enjoy the benefits of that growth.
Financial high flyer Joe Seifert, and those are his personal views, by the way, not those of his company. And we'll have more on inequality later in the programme. But first, I want to take a harder look at whether or not continued growth is physically possible. Here's the problem. Growth of 2 or 3% a year might not sound like very much, but it's exponential. So each year, the size of the increase is greater, even if the rate of growth remains steady. Sounds complicated, but in a nutshell, this means that with 3% growth, an economy will double in size every 23 years. Think of it like a pan of popcorn. You don't have much to begin with, but once it starts expanding, you run out of space pretty quickly. So, is this a serious concern? To find out, I went to the United States to meet with Professor Tom Murphy of the University of California, San Diego.
Hi, you Tom?
Yes, hi, Theo.
Yeah.
Hi, great to meet you. Come on in.
Tom is not an economist. In fact, he's a physicist, and he's deeply concerned about how we use energy and resources. So much so that he's designed his own home to be, as much as possible, self-sufficient.
I've got a number of dedicated solar outlets in the house that are fed from my off-grid system. I've got a bank of batteries in the garage, panels on the roof. Here we are standing by the refrigerator, and it's one of those devices in my house hooked to this dedicated circuit. So we use solar for all of our refrigeration, among other things in the house. So as we come outside, one of the first things you notice is some chickens clucking. So we can say hi to the girls. So here they're pecking at some corn and other delicious goodies. It's like candy for them. It's called scratch. They eat the scratch and the other food, and they give us eggs.
Up on your roof, those are the solar panels.
That's right. This is a system that I built, but I have 12 panels that are 130 watts each. So it's small, but it satisfies about 60% of our needs. Okay, so in the garage here, we find a huge bank of batteries. This is about 10 kilowatt hours of storage, and I can, if I wish, charge our plug-in hybrid electric car on this system as well. And in fact, you see the car charging right now. It's almost finished from its earlier trips in the day.
Tom likes precision. His day job involves shooting lasers at the moon to measure its orbit down to the nearest millimeter. And he thinks economists could do with some scientific rigor of their own. He writes a blog called Do the Math, in which he looks at issues such as energy use and climate change. He frequently challenges economic assumptions which he believes don't pay enough attention to sound scientific principles. In particular, he believes that one day our appetite for never-ending growth will simply fall foul of the laws of physics.
Well, anything that's exponential is dangerous because mathematically it knows no bounds. It represents a doubling every so many years, and mathematically speaking, that never stops. Our economic activity, at least in part, maybe even in large part, is based on physical activities and use of things like energy. And so we look at the last 3-4 centuries and we see this exponential growth in the rate at which we use energy. And if we extrapolate that, it leads to very absurd results. For instance, in 2,500 years, we would be using all the power from all the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. That's 100 billion stars, and using the entire output of all those stars. So clearly that's not going to happen.
Well, I should hope it isn't. It all seems rather apocalyptic after all. And to be fair, most economists don't normally look that far ahead. So on a more realistic timescale, what's actually going to happen?
On the timescale of civilization, our recent experience in this, you know, boom that we call the Industrial Revolution, I would call the Fossil Fuel Revolution, is a phase. It's a fairly short phase, and it's physically bound not to last. And so all of our assumptions about the way our world should work economically, interest rates, investment, the general notion of growth, has to be limited.
Okay, well, the Industrial Revolution has been going on for about 2.5 centuries. We seem to be managing pretty well so far. If what you're saying is correct, if the global economy were to grow at, say, 3% a year for the foreseeable future, how long have we actually got?
From a physical point of view, if we grew at 3% in something like 400 years, we would actually be boiling the oceans, not because of global warming and CO2, but just because of the heat that is a natural byproduct of the energy that we use. Every joule of energy that we use ends up dissipated as heat in some form, unless we're beaming it into space, which we're not. It's all thermodynamic and it's all staying here with us. So the waste heat from all these processes would bake us on the time scale of a few hundred years. Obviously, that's not going to happen. And so what's really likely to happen is the physical limits that do exist will start exerting downward pressure on what we can afford to do.
This view isn't wholly new. In fact, way back in the 18th century, the English cleric and scholar Thomas Malthus was making similar apocalyptic predictions. His concern wasn't energy use, but population growth, which he saw as a consequence of rising living standards. He believed that eventually the population would simply run out of food. It hasn't happened so far. In fact, we've just got better at growing what we need to eat. So I asked Tom, couldn't we simply use less energy, for example, and get around the problem that way?
Well, that's certainly what I've done in my life. And the economists would point out that I've spent money on things like solar panels in doing that. I think fundamentally, though, you run into a problem because some fraction of what we do will always be tied to physical resources. The economists like to speak of decoupling, where you can have less energy-intensive activities that still generate a lot of economic activity, and those things absolutely exist, and there are more of them today than there used to be, but you know, you're only going to engage in those activities after you've fed yourself, after you have enough energy to keep your lifestyle intact. So there will always be a floor of physical activity underneath any other business, and if that becomes finite, then the whole scheme is capped in terms of growth.
But what about renewable sources of energy? Principally the sun, because the sun is a limitless source of energy, surely, if we learn how to harness that properly.
Well, the sun has enormous potential. There's no doubt about it. In terms of all the other renewable options, it by far exceeds any other option in terms of its raw resource. So absolutely that becomes an ultimate limit. Just to put a number on things, at our current 3% per year energy growth rate, at least that's, you know, over the last few centuries, the historical growth rate, we would be using all of the sunlight to hit the Earth's land in something like 300 years. So even that gigantic resource that's about 10,000 times bigger than what we're using right now runs into limits.
So if we're running up against the limits of what the sun can provide, using all of the energy from the sun, if we don't do something, we're really going to be in trouble. That's what you're saying.
That's correct. And if we were actually, you know, using the sun to that extent, where are we growing our food? That number was 100% efficient panels covering 100% of the Earth's land.
Okay, well, you've mentioned a number of times the idea of a steady state economy. Just run by me what you believe that would entail.
So a steady state economy is something that would not build growth into the equation. You know, a lot of our economic institutions that thrive on growth now wouldn't necessarily operate the same way.
Could you give me some example of the institutions that wouldn't work?
Yeah. So what does it mean to invest money if there's no economic growth? If you don't have a 3% per year gain on capital, what does investment look like? What do loans look like? What are the function of banks? Do you put your money under a mattress because there's no incentive, there's no interest rate? So those are the kinds of things that are fundamental to how we think about the world. And in a steady state, those can be replaced by some kind of equivalent structures, but the fundamentals have really, really changed.
Okay, and looking at one of the things that growth is a driver for, increased prosperity, there are 3 billion people living in poverty in the world. If we can't rely on growth to lift those people out of poverty, what's going to happen?
Certainly the dream has been that we can bring the rest of the world up to Western standards, and that's a great dream, but it's hard to understand how it can happen in the sense that we are having trouble managing the planet at today's scale. So a typical Westerner lives at about maybe 5 times the energy per capita expenditure as the global average. So if we wanted to bring the world up to Western standards today, we're talking about 5 times the energy use. So if we're doing it on fossil fuels, which is our answer right now, where are you going to find 5 times the rate of oil? If we're getting 90 million barrels per day right now, where are you going to find another 400 million barrels a day? How many new continents are there? How many new giant oil reserves are there? The answer is you just can't do that. So something fundamentally has to change, and there's nobody in the world who's written down the prescription for how that actually works. Is it even realistic to have a solar-powered world at our current standard of living? It's not demonstrated that it's a viable path.
So if you can't grow, but you still want to lift people out of poverty, if you want to use the same level of energy without any form of growth, does that mean that the richer world has to accept a compromise in its own standard of living in order to allow other countries to catch up?
Well, that's certainly one way, I would say mathematically, to solve the problem is, okay, share the resources equally around, and then the Western world is living at 4 or 5 times less the energy that they use today, which, by the way, is exactly what I've done in my home. So that's part of the motivation, is to understand what would it mean to live at a lower energy standard, to have, you know, reduced expectations. And so I've taken a lot of measures in my own house. Not just putting solar panels, that's kind of window dressing. Most of it's behavioral changes, and most of it is just simply using less energy.
Professor Tom Murphy of the University of California, San Diego there. You're listening to Can the World Get Richer Forever on the BBC World Service with me, Theo Leggett. In part two of this program, I'll be speaking to an entrepreneur who thinks growth is vital to boost living standards in the developing world. And I'll also be speaking to an activist who thinks economic growth is the last thing poorer countries actually need. All of that and some stand-up comedy as well. That's coming up in a few moments' time.
A Richer World from the BBC World Service.
This is Rupa Jha from BBC Hindi, and I want to give you a taste of what it really means to live in India today.
1 week ago, it was about a 72-hour jam.
72 hours?
Yes.
So, for the past year, I've been following the lives of 4 very different people in my home state of Bihar.
Cooking, cleaning, education of children, farming, everything has to be done by me.
From a student trying to lift his family out of poverty.
If I don't make it, I will really shatter their home.
To the doctor struggling with the infrastructure.
The surgery is successful or the patient ends up with amputation of the left arm and the electricity went off.
And trying to work out why India still hasn't quite made it on the world stage.
The population grows 2 times in 3 years, then what do you do?
Living India. Part of the Richer World season on the BBC World Service. Online at bbcworldservice.com/documentaries.
You're listening to Can the World Get Richer Forever with me, Theo Leggett. In part two, I'll be asking why we need economic growth. We'll be hearing from one of Africa's leading entrepreneurs.
Our people need to have more of a voice. We need to understand as countries, as entrepreneurs, of what's important for our people.
And I'll be speaking to controversial Indian eco-campaigner Vandana Shiva, who thinks we fail to value the riches of the natural world. That's all coming up after the news.
BBC News with Jonathan Izard. More than 1 million people in Brazil have joined demonstrations demanding the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff over a huge corruption scandal in the state-owned oil company Petrobras. The largest demonstration is happening in Sao Paulo, with a gathering of 500,000 people. Dozens of people have been killed in a dawn raid on a village in central Nigeria. A local politician told the BBC that 81 villagers were killed when unidentified gunmen attacked the village in Benue State, setting fire to houses and slaughtering men, women and children. The American Secretary of State John Kerry has said he wants to reignite negotiations with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in order to bring an end to the country's civil war. The US has previously insisted that Mr. Assad should step down as part of a political settlement. Pope Francis has condemned the bombing of two churches in the Pakistani city of Lahore and called for an end to the persecution of Christians. At least 14 people were killed and more than 70 others wounded when suicide bombers attacked the churches during Sunday services. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has said he was ready to bring his country's nuclear weapons to combat readiness during the crisis in Ukraine last year. Mr. Putin said he believed the life of the deposed President Viktor Yanukovych was in danger after he was ousted in February. Police in Ferguson, Missouri have arrested a 20-year-old local man in connection with the shooting of two police officers last week during a demonstration following the resignation of Ferguson's police chief. Tension has been running high in the city since the killing of an unarmed black teenager by a white policeman in August. And the singer Elton John has called for a boycott of the Italian fashion designers Domenico Dolce and Stefano Gabbana after they used a magazine interview to criticise same-sex families and in vitro fertilisation. Sir Elton, who has two children with his husband David Furnish, condemned the designers as archaic in an Instagram post. BBC World Service News.
You're listening to Can the World Get Richer Forever? With me, Theo Leggett. So far in the programme, I've been looking at economic growth and asking whether or not it can continue indefinitely. Financial high flyer Joe Seifert told me he has high hopes that it can.
Since the Industrial Revolution, the last few hundred years, the world has been surprisingly resilient through world wars and famines and catastrophes and its ability to sustain growth. So I'm very optimistic around the future ability of the world to generate wealth.
But then I spoke to physics professor Tom Murphy, who believes the answer is an emphatic no, because eventually growth is certain to fall foul of physical laws.
From a physical point of view, if we grew at 3% in something like 400 years, we would actually be boiling the oceans, not because of global warming and CO2, but just because of the heat that is a natural byproduct of the energy that we use.
Well, I found what Tom had to say quite convincing, and also quite depressing. So, to cheer myself up, I flew to Seattle for a comedy evening.
My name is Yaron Bauman. I appear before you tonight, ladies and gentlemen, as the world's first and only stand-up economist. That's too late. It's a niche market.
Yaron Bauman is an economist who makes his living through stand-up comedy. It is, to say the least, an unusual mix.
I know when it comes to the budget deficit, the left blames the right and the right blames the left, but I actually blame the center. And I don't think we have a budget deficit because left-wing people believe in mandates or because right-wing people believe in markets. I think we have a budget deficit because people in the middle believe in magic. No, let me explain, all right? Every time a left-wing politician says, hey, I've got a great idea for a road or a school or a hospital, the response from swing voters is, yeah, let's do that. And then every time a right-wing politician says taxes are too high and we should cut taxes, the response from swing voters is, yeah, let's do that. And then it turns out we have a budget deficit, and swing voters blame the politicians, which is kind of ridiculous, right? I mean, this is like going to the doctor for your checkup, and the doctor tells you that you've been putting on weight, and the left side of your brain says, huh, I guess I better exercise more. And the right side of your brain says, huh, I guess I better stop eating so many donuts. And the middle part of your brain says, huh, I guess I better get a new doctor.
But Yoram isn't just an economist who does comedy. He's also a committed environmental campaigner and a firm advocate of using economic measures such as carbon pricing to tackle climate change. When I met him, he was appearing at a small church in a well-to-do suburb of Seattle, rallying support from an enthusiastic crowd of middle-aged locals.
I make a living doing stand-up comedy about economics. I do a fair number of talks for corporate events, and what I've learned is that if you make people laugh for 45 minutes, then you can talk to them about pretty much anything you want for 5 or 10 minutes. So I'm going to give you actually the same pitch that I give those folks.
which is a pitch about climate change and revenue-neutral carbon tax.
I was intrigued by his approach, so I decided to ask him if he believes that continued economic growth makes the destruction of the environment inevitable.
I don't know if I'd say that it's inevitable. I think it's inevitable with current technologies. So the current system that we have, people use, you know, internal combustion engine cars to get around, and we generate a lot of electricity from coal. It doesn't have to be that way. I do think that with growing wealth in the world, people are going to want to have electricity. They're going to want to have cars. I'm thinking in particular about China, India, Africa, places where a lot of folks don't have access to those things in the same way that, you know, folks in the United States or in Britain do. So I do think that increasing wealth globally is going to lead to demand for those end products, for electricity, for transportation. Whether that's going to necessarily have to come at the expense of the environment is, I think, a different issue.
Why would it not come at the expense of the environment? Because, for example, in China, we're seeing lots and lots of new coal-fired power stations opening up. There is a demand for power, there is cheap electricity from coal, and that's what's happening.
That's true, but that's with existing technologies. So if it's possible to get electricity from a source other than coal, so from wind or from solar or from geothermal, the dream is sort of if you could get the price of renewable energy down below the price of coal, then China would stop building coal-fired power plants and they'd start building, you know, renewable-fired power plants, and then you wouldn't have the climate problem.
But don't you come up against the law of decreasing returns? There's a lot of potential at the moment for doing that kind of thing, but ultimately, if the population continues to grow, if demand for resources continues to rise, then how far can improved efficiency actually go?
Well, there's a difference between efficiency in terms of energy efficiency and clean energy sources. So energy efficiency, you're right that there's probably a limit to, well, how many miles a gallon can you get in a car? But if you could develop a car that runs on fuel cells or an electric car and then find a clean way to generate the power for that electric car or for those fuel cells, then there are no limits to that. You could potentially have everybody in the world having a car and they would be able to do just fine without increasing carbon emissions because you've sort of split off the technology from the carbon production.
So do you think that's going to happen, that in future the global wealth can continue to grow without the environment being held hostage?
I think that's a plausible future, and that's one that I work towards. I don't think it's inevitable. I think there's a chance, and I think that it's kind of our best shot, because if it comes down to a point where people are going to have to choose between electricity and saving the climate, I'm not sure that people are going to choose saving the climate.
Some economists think that the world is heading for resource wars, that resources are going to become increasingly scarce and people are actually going to fight over raw materials. I take it you don't agree with that point of view.
Well, I do think that over the centuries, in fact, there have been discussions about peak oil, peak coal, actually going back to the economist Stanley Jevons in England, who worried that England was going to run out of coal, and that was in the 1800s. I think that human ingenuity has proven to be incredibly good at digging fossil fuels out of the ground. And the same is true with other resources. So, you know, we now have magazine headlines that say that gas is cheap, and the folks who were talking about peak oil a couple of years ago are not talking so much about peak oil. So the general catchphrase that I like to use to summarize the issue from my perspective is that I don't worry about running out of fossil fuels. I worry about not running out of fossil fuels.
So given what you're saying, do you think that global wealth can continue to increase, that the industrialization of countries like India and China is something that we can deal with, that we can all continue getting richer?
I think it's almost surely something that's going to happen. And so I tend to think more about how are we going to accommodate that as opposed to is it possible for it to happen, because I think it is going to happen. Can we see growth in India and China without the collapse of world ecosystems? I think that there's a chance that we'll be able to come through that. I'm not going to guarantee you that we will. I think there's going to be some damage. I look at issues like endangered species, for example. I think that's a very difficult issue to address, and to be honest, it's one that I don't work on because I don't see a clear path to go from here to there. But I look at climate change issues, and I do feel like there's a way to address that problem, and that's why I spend a lot of time working on it. The other thing I'll add on this point is that if you go back and you look at, you know, what folks said, like you look at Paul Ehrlich, who's a famous environmentalist at Stanford, he had this quote from one of his books where he says that nothing is as misleading to our children as our current affluent society. So he was basically saying, look, there's no way that we can continue this path that we're on of resource consumption. Well, he said that in a book that was published in, you know, the 1960s.
And we've carried on since then.
It certainly is true that our consumption patterns have continued to increase dramatically. So from the perspective of has global wealth continued to increase since the 1960s, the answer is clearly yes. Does that mean that everything's fine? Well, there are still these environmental concerns that we need to deal with, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Do you think we need to start measuring global wealth in a different way? Because one of the things I took from your talk last night was that people can perceive something as making them wealthier, a particular transaction, a particular trade, and I guess that goes for countries as well as individuals. But in the long run, it can actually harm everybody.
It's possible to talk about alternative measures of GDP, for example, but I think it's more important to actually look at kind of the goal of economics or macroeconomics in many ways is to raise living standards. And even though people think that economics is all about money, living standards are actually about a lot more than money. So one of the reasons why I like to live in Seattle is that Seattle is beautiful, at least during certain times of the year. And when I lived in Beijing, one of the things that people in Beijing were upset about was the air pollution in Beijing. And that's something that factors into standard of living, into quality of life issues just as much, in some instances more so, than money. So I'd be hesitant to just try to box in this idea that, you know, that the only thing that anybody cares about is money, because quality of life is a much broader concept.
Economist, environmentalist, and stand-up comedian Yoram Bauman there. You're listening to Can the World Get Richer Forever on the BBC World Service with me, Theo Leggett. And so far, I've looked at whether or not it's physically possible to have continued economic growth. But now I want to find out whether or not that growth is actually needed or wanted. Because one thing is clear, while the world has grown a great deal wealthier since the Industrial Revolution, the benefits of that wealth have overwhelmingly been felt by a privileged few. Western countries have prospered, but others have been left behind. So if the world is to keep on getting richer, does that growth need to be more evenly balanced? Well, to find out more, I've come to the Swiss ski resort of Davos in the Alps. Once a year, this place becomes little short of a shrine to wealth and growth when it hosts the annual World Economic Forum. It's a truly extraordinary event where billionaires rub shoulders with presidents to discuss the pressing issues of the day, such as global warming or inequality, where entrepreneurs eagerly swap ideas in bars and hundreds of hangers-on and wannabes dream that one day this wealth and power could be theirs. Now I've come here to meet with one man who knows a great deal about wealth creation. In fact, his own story is a remarkable one of rags-to-riches endeavour, and I'm due to meet him in a restaurant somewhere around here.
So my name is Ashish J. Thacker. I'm the founder of the Mara Group and the Mara Foundation.
Ashish Thacker is 35 and very wealthy. His company, the Mara Group, has operations across Africa in fields such as technology, financial services and outsourcing. British-born to Ugandan-Asian parents, he moved to Rwanda with his family in the late 1980s. But during the civil war that followed, they lost everything. After settling in Uganda as a teenager, he began importing computer parts from Dubai to make a living, and eventually turned that one-man operation into a multinational business. He was in Davos as one of the World Economic Forum's young global leaders, and he told me that Africa, at least, really needs economic growth. But, he said, it has to be the right type of growth.
You know, when you think about growth, when you think about developing markets in particular, the minute it starts becoming about speculation and making a quick buck out of that cycle rather than actually impacting lives. Because you're right, in emerging markets, it's seen as taking people out of poverty. But if that mindset is lost and you start just focusing on how to cream natural resources in some of these countries and not giving back to the communities and not adding value to local raw materials, it just doesn't make sense, right? So I think growth needs to be sustainable. You need players who actually understand that and want to be long-term and not just make a quick buck.
Because the history of many African nations has been, hasn't it? On the surface, reasonable growth rates because of the sale of natural resources, but very little benefiting the populations.
I disagree. We have had great growth rates. Some of our countries haven't managed resources well, but a lot of our countries have managed resources well. And there is a lot of people coming out of poverty. There is a middle-class sector that's booming, that's upcoming. So I think differently, where we do have a strong middle class that's upcoming. We do have real, genuine growth that's not just speculated or thrown out there. 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies of the world are in Africa. So I think it is real.
Do you think that growth, though, is finite? Do you think it can carry on for 10, 20, 30, 40 years at current rates, or is there a limit to this?
I think for the medium term, for sure, it's going to continue. And like I said, just because we have so many actual requirements, we're a net importer of everything. All of our countries are. Even the countries that have the resources are still net importers of those same products that they can actually manufacture locally. So power, the fact that, you know, we have 75 terawatts in sub-Saharan Africa with 800 million people, Spain has 75 terawatts of power with 40 million people. It's not a problem. It's not a challenge. It's an opportunity. It's something that we need 20 times more power today. The more power we bring in the system, the more manufacturing will come about, the more consumerism will boost, the more we'll create our own economies in that respect. So there's just so much to be done on the continent. We have over 1 billion people, and our growth rates, there were more babies born in Nigeria last year than the whole of Western Europe, which is unbelievable.
So Africa has huge potential, but if it reaches that potential, there's further pressure on natural resources and on the environment that is already, by all accounts, under strain. Do you think there needs to be some kind of balancing going on, that perhaps the Western world needs to grow more slowly in order to let Africa and other developing regions grow faster?
I don't look at it that way. I think if we're going to add value to our local resources, whether the West grows faster or not, we need our resources for ourselves. And even if they're value added and we're exporting them, that's even better. We don't mind being a provider, but we want to be a provider that's value added. There's no point in selling a coffee bean for a dollar and then it's processed and sold for $10 in the West, right? It doesn't add up when you think about it, right? Now, in some cases, you're not going to have a choice but to do stuff like that. But can we refine? Can we actually process it and pack it for big global retailers rather than just exporting the raw beans and letting all the value add happen somewhere else? And therefore, my answer to your question is, I think Africa's growth will come about. And I think if there's more growth globally, it's actually probably a better thing because we're getting a lot of global investments coming onto the continent as well. So,
but do you think that growth will come under pressure, for example, from environmental legislation?
We have tight environmental legislations in place today. It's not like we're doing things that are going to damage the environment and then, you know, say, oops, 10 years down the line. No, it's not like that. There are strong environmental human rights groups. There's a lot of those policies and governance and global standards that have really come into play. So I don't think we're behind on that kind of stuff.
And do you think that can, at a fundamental level, benefit the, I think it's 3 billion people in the world who live on less than $2.50 a day? Can the kind of growth you're talking about actually start to address that problem?
In my opinion, yes, I think it can. But when you say growth, it really depends on where you mean growth and where you put that wealth factor that's going to be associated with that growth. Are we saying that the rich should get richer? No. So if we're going to put up a very large natural resources project in one of our countries and one family takes all the benefit, then there's no point in that. How do we actually ensure and create systems around local beneficiation down to the grassroots that everybody plays a role and everybody benefits out of it? That's going to be crucial. So growth will come, yes. It's the type of growth that I'm worried about more than anything else. Something that we need to address, take seriously, be innovative about, and be practical about as well.
It's an extremely difficult question. Do you have any of the answers? What do you think needs to be done?
I think our people need to have more of a voice. We need to understand as countries, as entrepreneurs, of what's important for our people and how that if they benefit, we will benefit more as well. So I think it's thinking about the bigger picture where it's not about just our own growth. If people around us don't grow as well and are not succeeding in what they're doing, our growth isn't going to be sustainable. So on a practical note, even if businesses, and I hope they don't do it for that reason, but even if they look at it selfishly for their own interests, that their businesses continue growing, they've got to ensure the environment around them is also growing at a sustainable manner, in a sustainable manner at a constant pace. But I think that's why it comes down to doing good and doing well. It's a crucial thing. Let's do good and let's do well. Sometimes people do well in the world promising to do good, but forget about it or don't get too busy for it. Let's genuinely do good and we will do well.
And that was Ashish J. Thakkar, Chief Executive of the Mara Group. He thinks growth can benefit developing countries a great deal and bring people out of poverty. But others disagree and question the motives of the businesses which create that growth. Well, to find out more, I've come to India and to the city of Dehradun. It lies in the shadows of the Himalayas in the north of the country. And as you can hear, it's a noisy and bustling place, a hubbub of cars, construction and commerce. Here, elegant, brightly painted villas sit cheek by jowl with ramshackle huts, tiny shops and sprawling new apartment complexes. Pigs, dogs and even the odd cow forage in the debris at the roadside. So it's a pretty good example of the contrasts and contradictions of modern India, a country that's experienced huge growth over the past two decades, that's seen as an emerging economic powerhouse, but in which a fifth of the population still live in poverty. Yet little more than half an hour's drive from Dehradun, here in the calm green countryside of the Doon Valley, you get a very different view of India and of its economy. This is home to Navdanya, an environmental foundation which is deeply suspicious of globalization and economic growth. At the end of a quiet lane bordered on both sides by shady mango trees is Navdanya's biodiversity farm, where it uses traditional methods to cultivate seeds which are passed on to farmers. Darwin Singh Negi, who helped to establish the farm 20 years ago, showed me around.
Actually, problem is young generation, they don't have any idea how to do the organic farming and how to keep soil healthy. So that's the problem, and we are giving solution for that. So this is seed bank. Here you can see it's more than 1,500 variety of seeds. This is only display so that people can come here and they can see the each variety. Because right now, young generation, they don't have any idea how the seed look like.
Can I see some of the seeds and feel them?
If you want to see the rice, this is vegetable, different spices, vegetable, everything. Some lentil also.
The lentils I recognize. Yeah. These are more unusual seeds. What are these?
This is one kind of soya we call. Soy.
So that's in so many foods, and yet I've never actually seen the seeds before. They're very small and grassy, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. That's why I said this is for display, so that people can see in front of their eyes, no?
Navdanya is the brainchild of Vandana Shiva, a crusading and often controversial environmental activist. She thinks India's recent all-out quest for growth has caused the country enormous harm. I asked her why.
Not only do I live in the part of the Indian cultural ecological space, which is paying the price for the story of growth, but also because so much of my own life's evolution, my own learning, has been based on being taught by the people of India who are paying a price. Let me begin with 40 years ago. And of course, the debate in that period was particularly around forests. And the establishment was saying, got to log the trees, got to have revenue, got to have growth. And the women were saying, these are not timber mines. Their main produce is not revenue and timber. Their main produce is soil and water and pure air. And of course, at that point, it looked like the women were blocking growth. They were arrested. They were thrown into jail. 1978, we had a flood so bad after a major logging operation on a mountain slope. And the flood went all the way to Calcutta. That's the day the government woke up and said, they're right. The main function of these forests is conserving the soil and water because we get a pathetic amount of revenue and we count that. But the costs that come in destabilizing the mountains, causing droughts, causing floods, is not counted. But when it was counted because they had to do flood relief, it was a much bigger cost. The mountain forests are today managed as conservation forests. Every story of growth is a story of environmental footprint that wasn't counted, of social dislocation that wasn't counted. So all this high growth figure is not counting the social, cultural, ecological destruction of India.
But on the other side of the coin, if you go back to the 1960s, I think the poverty rate in India was about 65%. Nowadays, it's in the order of 20%, still very, very high, still hundreds of millions of people. But isn't that an improvement?
Problem with poverty measures is they're measured in terms of cash flows, just like growth is only measured in terms of commodification. All it measures is how much entered the commercial world. It doesn't measure what is the life you're living? What is the nutrition you're eating? What is the quality of your life? None of that is measured. I've worked in villages where there's not a rupee of cash handling. Everything is barter. When you measure growth only in terms of flow of cash, sadly, it is not measuring the removal of poverty.
And you clearly feel that
in agriculture and beyond, the commercial sector's exploitation of resources is not a good thing. But do you not feel that commercial entities can provide services, can provide help in people's lives that maybe wouldn't otherwise be there, wouldn't be available?
Well, I never work in abstract generalizations. Yeah? So wouldn't you like this generally around the world? Wouldn't it be good if fairies were dropping down from heaven and planting our crops? These counterfactuals don't work. You bring me a particular giant corporation, bring me a particular service, and I'll see, discuss with communities. They'll decide you want a new mega dam or not. You want a highway through cut through your village and displace you or not. I think they're clear screens through which you can ensure the democratic rights are not violated and actual well-being is improved. It's not rocket science.
You make it sound as though every business in the world, every multinational, is intent on raping the land, on stealing resources and almost wantonly creating pollution. Is that really the case? Aren't some businesses perfectly responsible, perfectly capable of generating money without being destructive?
Well, I qualified when I said that as a businesses that live off the logic of extraction. If the river requires this much water to flow to stay alive, then I will only take this much. But if I want all of the river's water, I must kill the river. So any corporation that has limitless seeking of profits must violate the ecological limits of the planet. And the idea of limitless growth doesn't go with the idea that those 99% you're pushing out have their share in that wealth, because the wealth at the end of the day is social wealth. Being rich means living a full life, living a life of meaning, having work for your hands and your minds and your heart, having a wide circle of compassion to give. On that, there is no limit.
Indian activist Vandana Shiva there. So what is the answer then? Can the world really get richer forever? Well, if getting richer means consuming ever more energy and resources in order to boost economic output, then it's highly unlikely. What we can do, of course, is make better use of what we have, and technology clearly has a major role to play. Even so, there may well be limits. But as we've been hearing, economic growth isn't everything, and it may be possible to boost quality of life in other ways. Perhaps then we need to redefine what we mean by wealth and place greater value on natural capital. Perhaps too we'll need to share the wealth we have more evenly or face ever greater inequality. But one way or another, it's a question that needs to be solved. And I think it's fair to say the approach we've used since the dawn of the industrial age may one day have to be consigned to history. Can the World Get Richer Forever was presented by me, Theo Leggett. The producers were myself and Sonia Rothwell. The programme's part of the A Richer World season on the BBC. For more details, please visit our website at bbcworldservice.com.